So, yesterday on Drive Time, the IFA president, Tim Cullinan, was talking about the issue of food inflation, and he gave an overview of the trends in this area, the input costs which are contributing to why food is what it is, an expensive commodity on the country's shelves.
Food inflation has been increasing over the last number of months now, or almost a year now. But, you know, we're coming off the back of years of deflation. Food prices was going down for the last 10 years. Actually, 20 years, food prices had been going down. And, you know, we're seeing a levelling off here now. And I suppose there's a few reasons for that. And, of course, the first one, obviously, is the cost of production. You know, we've seen in the same period, in the last 10-year period, electricity costs was up somewhere in the region of 127%. All our other costs, you know, food, or feed, fuel and fertilizer, obviously since the start of the war in Ukraine, we see massive inflation there as well, not coming down in line with the rest of the general economy. And, you know, from an environmental point of view, if we go back to this time last year, the government agreed a reduction of 25% in emissions from agriculture, and we're working on that. We're working on that plan. And obviously there's a lot of costs associated with that plan.
And that was Tim Cullinan, as I say, the president of the IFA. Pat O'Toole, to you first, as political editor of the Irish Farmers Journal. Just interpret that last bit of it for us. We'll get to some of the environmental issues a bit later on in the programme. But just the costs associated with environmental issues, what would he be referring to there?
Well, there's two types of costs, I suppose. One is the expenditure to bring in the technology and the new systems. The other is the cost in terms of reducing the level of inputs, which has an effect on yield. So, and I suppose the third one then is all important one of land. There's a huge demand and a range of competing demands for land resources, some of them being driven by our attempts to bring down the carbon footprint of our land use, not just from farming, but for other land uses as well. We're still waiting, while we have that 25% climate target for agriculture, we're waiting for the parallel land use change and forestry target. In the meantime, that's a big unknown, but we have a range of competing interests, which has rocketed the price of land for rental. It's in the, so I suppose, the dairy region, land has gone over €500 an acre a year on a 10-year lease, which would be almost double what it was 5 years ago.
Okay, well, that gives us some insight. We'll come back to some of that, as I say, when we're looking at issues around environmental concerns and climate mitigation measures in agriculture just a bit later on the programme. But the input costs that Tim Cullinan was talking about, could it be said that viability in any area of agriculture was threatened as those input costs rose after Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine?
That was the fear last year, and it was a very real fear, because costs trebled, cost of fertiliser trebled, the cost of fuel doubled, and feed went up by well over 50% in response, and they're the key inputs. But those fears weren't realised last year. We had exceptional prices, and we also had very good growing conditions and very good yields of milk and of crops. So last year was actually a very good year for farming. But we've seen consistently through history that when prices spike of commodities and of inputs, the high prices for the inputs for farming outlast the high prices for the commodities. And that's where we are now. Milk has gone down 15 cent a litre, which is bringing it down from 55 to 40 cent a litre, and it's now a break-even price in the last 3 months. Grain is back from over €300 a tonne to under €200 a tonne, and again, that's heading for break-even or below it, depending on yield. There's real fears that this year is going to bite in the way we feared last year would.
And when you're talking about those prices, this is the price paid to the producer.
Correct.
By the middleman. The consumer might have noticed no particular difference in this.
Yeah, and the big fear is that as prices contract a little from the all-time highs and the sudden spikes of 2022, that retailers will pass those cost reductions, which we've already seen for, you know, fruit and vegetables and for milk in recent weeks, and for bread, that those will be passed straight back to the producer by the retailer.
All right, and just before, we get to the rest of the panel on this, you said, because of the rising prices to the consumer, that viability in sectors of agriculture wasn't threatened. Is there a danger that with the lowering of costs that are being paid to the producer now, that even, I suppose, post the spike in all the input costs, that you actually could see people being threatened?
that's the pinch point. This year is quite dangerous for all producers. But even last year, we saw real pressure in the fruit and vegetable sector, which is the shortest food chain. It's literally producer, retailer, consumer. And the prices didn't rise there. There's long contracts, you know, huge planning, very large scale, small number of producers. They should be the ones with a very close relationship with the market. And they were the ones who suffered most. And it's ironic in terms of the transition in food consumption that some people would want us to journey on, that those producers who would be in the heart of that transition are the ones who are most threatened at the moment.
All right. Martin Hayden, how is that dealt with? I mean, I know the government had this retail forum and there was supposed to be greater transparency about prices. But if you're trying to keep small sustainable producers in the game with the eye on a long-term transition into better, more sustainable agriculture, how do you protect them at a time like this without the data that's needed to actually go to the retailers and say, we know you're screwing them?
So what you do is you do exactly what government is doing right now, introducing new legislation that establishes a food regulator. And that's about getting equity in the relationship between the primary producer, the farmer, the processor in the middle, and the retailer. And too often farmers have been price takers in that position and you know, have felt that they have not been in a strengthened position. So that food regulator's legislation, which we're at the latter stages of through the Dáil now, and it's come through the committee that Michael will be, and Claire will be familiar with, a lot of work has happened in that to date, that will strengthen the position of the farmer and of the primary producer here. We don't want to see retailers profiteering in terms of, you know, taking advantage of the time we've come through here with consumers. But similarly, we don't want to see reductions that are happening, that the farmers have to pay the price for that, that would inevitably maybe push them below the cost of production and into a position of being unviable. There was a couple of unique circumstances last year for certain sectors, like pigs, like poultry, that were very dependent, are very dependent on energy as well as on feed. And they, their very existence was really threatened. And that's why the state stood in with two different tranches of multi-million euro investment to support the sector. We also had an individual package for the horticulture sector, and we had the fodder scheme for farmers to support them through that time to make sure we had enough fodder last year. So government stands ready as the year goes on to, in real time, look at this, but it's about having the safety in place and overall mechanisms.
When is the regulator likely to be in place?
So it got through the Dáil last week. I think it's due to go to the Shannon now next. It's finishing committee stage. So we're at stage four of a 5-stage process. So it'll be passed before summer recess.
All right. Michael Fitzmaurice, enough?
Well, look, it's a step forward. We had to do it because I think the EU was making us, every country has to do this. You welcome that. But like at the end of the day, I think we have to be realistic as well. They have certain amount of powers, but they're not going to upskittle the market upside down for the simple reason. Today, there's like something like 250 euro if you kill an animal in the north compared with here. And markets say if beef is 450 a kilo in Germany, you're not like they're going to be hitting the beef in as hard as they can. We export 90% of our beef. We're reliant on exports. That's the bottom line. You know, there's no point in recording ourselves in the line of beef. In the line of vegetables, what has gone on in vegetables, basically the stuff has been flown in to knock the daylights out of the producers here. And like the sad part about it is that we are losing the vegetable producers right around this country, which is a sad situation because we know now with the, when the war went on to try and be reliant.
So how do you avoid that situation in your view?
Well, in my opinion, we need to make sure that we put basically, be it on the cap or be it on some financial help to the likes of the vegetable producers, because we cannot keep losing them. We become vulnerable then if we do that. And that's very important to do. But on top of that, you know, milk was the big, you know, and Pat talked about it there. I think there was a big announcement that it was going from 2 tin to 2 euro for the 2 litre. That's what they announced. But bear in mind that farmer is gone from 55, 60 cent down to 40. So the 60 cent in the middle. And to be fair about it, the processors of the milk, they get their
have beat. Their own input costs.
Yeah, well,
as well.
They have input costs, and they're not on the big cream, in my opinion, that the ones that's putting it up on the shelf is on. And at the end of the day, the Irish people are buying into it because they're going out and going into them shops
but,
and buying it.
But you Clare Coran, you can see it from a certain point of view. We just don't know where, in terms of breaking it down into where that money is going. We don't know that yet. Mm-hmm. And we may never know it.
Absolutely. And that's been a big issue. It is the lack of transparency, particularly from when the produce leaves the farm gate to when it appears on the shelf. We all know what we pay in the supermarkets, and that's the gap. And look, there's a lot of hope now placed on the new agri-food regulator. We all want it to work. Of course we do. But it's not going to be able to look at competition. I think that's a mistake. We had an amendment passed that would allow the regulator access to really important information from the likes of the retailers and processors, including around margins. That's important. But whether or not the agri-food regulator is going to be able to access this information, be able to access all of the information they're going to need, all of that is up in the air until it's introduced and we see how it actually works. But it does need to work for farmers. Because at the end of the day, as prices go up and down, and they will, we still haven't got to a point where we can say, the primary producer who works damn hard is getting a fair price for the produce. And 9 times out of 10, they're not. There's not many workers in this country that will go to work for less money than it costs them to get there in the first place. Farmers are doing that. And I hear what's been said in relation to, you know, being viable. But a lot of farmers have really struggled with the high input costs in the last year. They really have. And I think a lot of them are really questioning their future. And I think this is really putting pressure on them, and has done, and continues to. Prices are still really high. Input prices are still really high. Fertilisers come down a bit. That's welcome. But farmers have struggled, and I think they're going to continue to, unless we get the likes of the agri-food regulator right, which can make a difference, and I hope it does.
Pat O'Toole, what do people want in the farming sector? What do they want from the agri-food regulator in terms of powers and in terms of action that would be taken on foot of the findings?
What they're looking for is transparency. If you go back to 2019, when beef farmers went to the factory gates and there was a 7-week blockade, they were looking for transparency and equity. Is it deliverable? I'm not sure. And especially when you look at the beef sector, the dairy sector, as Michael said, we export between 85 and 90% of the produce from those two key sectors. We export most of our sheep meat. So the battle between the Irish retailer and the Irish farmer, it is really a sideshow. The processors who kill our beef, and the co-ops, farmer owned, who process our milk, they're exporting globally. Yeah. And the reality is that global food prices are going to be the determinant, and the regulator can only do so much within the confines of the state. So it can be a price setter, and that's the advantage. One of the big problems is that our key retailers, they don't report their profits, and we don't know how much money they're making. And that's a real problem from the farmer's perspective, because it creates an area of doubt around their level of margin. So that's something that, you know, if it was addressed, it would be a help.
Colin, one thing I think that needs to be said, farmers don't want to see the buyer or the people that's buying the goods in the shops, they don't want to see them having to pay astronomical prices. Let's be very
clear. That's not, I suppose, in any producer's interest. But they don't want to depress the market.
And they're very prudent in the line of that they know well that if meat or whatever, or milk or whatever, goes to a certain price, that there's a fall off at certain times. They don't want to see that, but it's very important as well that the input costs are brought down, because the input costs have put an untold, you know, okay, fertiliser is down a bit, but electricity is still there. All the different meal is still there. All the different, the diesel is still pricey. All the different parts of it. And if the input costs are high, and the other thing that no one has mentioned is the interest rates. And that's going to catch an awful lot of the young farmers that have invested heavily over the last few years.
All right, Martin Hayden, you have a second hat as a cattle farmer as well. So what are the input costs?
Look, the input costs are really significant. I mean,
in the farming side of your life, what does it look like over the last while then?
Look, you're as a part-time farmer who obviously is a full-time politician, myself and my wife at home, and we have 4 young kids, we have a small farm in Kildare, and very dependent on contractors. So my contractor fees has gone up very significantly, because the cost of them, tending to the tillage crops has significantly increased. The cost of the fertiliser to grow the grass for my cattle has increased significantly, as it has for all beef and tillage farmers around the country who are listening to this right now. So some of those costs directly were impacted by the invasion in Ukraine, and the likes of fertiliser we're seeing starting to come back down now, albeit slowly, and those other challenges are there. But it does get to the net margin point. And that's why, you know, dead right to talk about the fact that we are so dependent on exports. And one of my responsibilities in the Department of Agriculture is Minister with Responsibility for New Market Development. And a key part of us here is about making sure, particularly in the context of post-Brexit, that we grow more markets and we grow the highest value markets for our produce. And that's why I'm regularly on trade missions to America, Middle East and Asia to make sure that we are getting into those highest value markets that will give the best return.
Seeing as you mentioned it there, Brexit, I mean, the nearest market to us, Britain, has signed... What people were shocked at the time. They, you know, the British Trade Minister came home. She celebrated the fact that a deal had been signed with New Zealand. They said, "Look, we're capable of doing deals," and it was more disadvantageous. And British farmers were up in arms because of cheap imports into Britain. How are Irish imports going to compete with that in the post-Brexit era? Are we just looking at new markets?
So what the. You know, in the post-Brexit era, what it is talking about is identifying the risks. The UK is still a really important market for Irish farmers. We export about 37% of our exports go to the UK because they pay really well for it. And in that market, outside of locally produced British food, ours is the next trusted.
But it hasn't been tested against the likes of New Zealand lamb yet, has it?
No, but absolutely the medium-term risk of... Like, farmers haven't been hit with the full impact, Irish farmers, of Brexit, because the medium-term risk is when the UK goes to do trade deals with third countries, what do they have to offer up? Only a population of 60 million and the food and drink that they consume. So that is a very obvious threat for us, and that's why we are deleveraging our dependency on the UK. We're not leaving them. They're still a very important trading partner for us. We want to maintain that close working relationship.
But it's not the future.
But we have to grow all the other options. So if you look at what Tirlan, formerly Glanbia, did with their cheese plant down in Bellevue, they partnered with Royal Ayware, a Dutch company, who have routes to market for soft continental cheese. That's reducing their dependency for the 4,500 dairy farmers in the southeast of the country to produce milk for Tirlan, reducing the dependency on the cheddar cheese market in the UK and going for the higher value soft continental cheese market in the EU. That's a perfect example of diversification of risk on the
Brexit.
One thing
that we're forgetting here is that this has happened already in the last 6 months in the sheep trade, where China was closed down, the Australian and New Zealand lamb was dumped in on Europe and in the UK. It's not alone the UK, it was in Europe as well. And the price just got smothered completely. The people that generally bought store lambs and fed them last winter, they were dying in debt, the lamb was. And that's a fierce vulnerability that we have. What has happened down through the years is we have a tendency to go for the near neighbour and always use them for basically our beef. But what is happening around the world is very important as well. Bear in mind that the likes of Brazil is looking at increasing their herd by up to 20 million. And if the likes of that happens, the EU seems to be more content now to import the gear from somewhere else, tick a box, and have the Irish farmer looking out through a half door.
All right. Claire Curran, would you agree with that assessment about the EU approach to agriculture, that the indigenous farmers within Europe are on the way to being sold out through trade deals? Because at the moment, the Mercosur trade deal is held up. So is that borne out?
Well, look, the Mercosur deal, I suppose, is a prime example of the threat for farmers here and in the EU as well. And I understand from an article in the Farming Independent today that that deal looks like it's coming back up for talks again in a matter of months. I think it's in July. So, I mean, that trade deal hasn't gone away. It's still on the table, you know, and we need to stand firm in relation to what that trade deal is going to mean.
What do you mean stand firm?
I mean, burning the Amazon, you know, serious damage to climate action, while at the same time telling Irish farmers, you know, one way you're sustainable and other ways you're not. We want to reduce what's here, and yet we want to import thousands from the likes of South America. I mean, this deal is going to have serious repercussions and consequences. It's not the route the EU should be going down. And I think we're going to have a major challenge on our hands. I don't know if the Irish government have been clear in relation to their position on it in the first instance, but I think we need to stand firm in relation to standing firmly against the Mercosur trade deal. And I do understand it is going to come up. It's still on the table.
But if you look at those Mercosur countries as an export market, you know, for Irish goods and services that we want to get out there, how do we tell them we want to export if we don't import? And one of their main driving exports is, you know, is meat and, you know, in certain cases.
Just be very clear on this. There's more involved in BMWs and cars in it than there is in beef.
I think I think the prime example is look at the damage that's been done in relation to producing beef in the likes of South America compared to here. There is no comparison in relation to it. So, I mean, we have very good produce in relation to beef as an example, and it is produced sustainably. That is not the case in the likes of South America. So it really needs to be looked at. It is going to come to the table, and we need to be firm in standing in resistance to it, and the Irish government need to do their job at EU level.
In the programme for government, Martin Aidan, you commit to firmly defending Ireland's interest in international trade deals, and Mercosur gets a particular mention. How do you defend what is for Ireland a particular niche offering in terms of high-priced grass-fed beef? You know, who are our allies in this in terms of protecting that sector in the face of the Mercosur trade deal?
France will be one of our main allies, and since the UK has left with Brexit, you know, you build new alliances, and we've built a very close relationship with the French in areas like this. And in any trade negotiations, as a country, you're going to be have your defensive strategies about your defending your own interests. And in terms of Mercosur, Minister Coveney was only out last week as Minister for Trade in Brussels, again reiterating those points and the concerns we'd have around environmental equality, if you like, that, you know, European farmers are being asked.
Let's put it in a nutshell. This is the issue, isn't it? If we ask Irish farmers to be more sustainable and to reduce emissions and to try and be more environmentally friendly, the question repeatedly comes up, why should Irish farmers take a step back in terms of herd numbers or anything else if the gaps in our export markets are going to be filled by Brazilian beef farmers who are cutting down rainforests for beef ranches?
Absolutely. And the idea of trade deals is that they make countries like Brazil stop knocking the rainforest, they raise the environmental standard, and there shouldn't be displacement underneath. So we've made that point very clearly, and there's a reason Mercosur has been going on for 25 years and still isn't done, because we've raised those points and those defensive interests. But let me be very clear here. We are a small, open nation. We export 90% of the food and drink we produce. We are a pro-trade country and a pro-trade government because it is good for our country.
I'll come to Paddy just a second. I just want to ask you one question, though, because on that, what impact is Ireland having, or what impact even, you know, we are as part of the EU, because the EU has gone around the world in tandem with the US at the time of the war in Ukraine, has basically insisted on people taking sides and condemning Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Brazil is sitting on the fence, so EU influence in Brazil has its limits. So how do we satisfy ourselves that those environmental standards we're demanding in any trade deal are being lived up to?
Well, they haven't been lived up to now, and that's why the deal hasn't gone ahead. And that's a very clear fact of it, and these can be clearly monitored. But the fact is that the EU has done trade deals, and obviously we're a part of the EU, so we benefit every time the EU does a new trade deal. And from that perspective, the more new trade deals that are done, I feel, has been very positive. I'm not surprised to hear what Claire says about kind of being against trade deals, because that's been Sinn Féin's position consistently across Europe. They oppose...
What do you make of Michael Fitzmaurice's point about the BMWs and everything else, that the big manufacturing sector in Europe that wants to export to Mercosur countries...
Absolutely.
And like the value of those exports as against... Agricultural exports.
Trade deals have different elements and pros and cons. And I'm saying we defend our national interest. That's why Mercosur hasn't happened before now. But just to make it clear here, the two trade deals that did benefit Ireland significantly, Singapore and Vietnam, were both opposed by Sinn Féin. So trade deals are generally very good for us. They'll be good with bad. Mercosur is a particular one. We've defended our interest on that, and we will continue to do so. And as you say, we've clearly outlined that.
Claire Curran back in here before I go to you, Pat O'Toole. About Sinn Féin blanketly opposing trade deals. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, you take a trade deal on its merits. There are serious issues in relation to Mercosur. It's not just Sinn Féin raising the flag in relation to it. In fact, many others have. Well, those trade deals are in place now, and But Mercosur isn't finalised yet. It is on the table, and we're not getting a clear answer from government. If this is going to be discussed in July, what is the Irish government position on it? That needs to be really clear in relation to, as has been said, serious environmental damage going on. One standard here for Irish farmers and then another out there. That's not on. We haven't got clarity from you in relation to that.
You've absolutely clarity on that from me. And just let me make one point here. We tried protectionism in this country in the 1940s, 1950s, and Ireland was a very poor place. Right. So that anti-trade approach from Sinn Féin would be really damaging.
Wait a second.
When a trade deal is agreed, before it's voted on, Haven't I correct in saying that the gear starts moving and until someone doesn't ratify it, then it blocks it. Is that correct?
So there's certain parts of trade is in EU competence and some part are national competence. But the fact is, Michael, it hasn't happened before now because we have clearly articulated, we've built alliances across the EU to defend our national interests with very clear specific points around the environmental elements. If the Brazilians change their view on that, then that's
Well, just to Martin's last point, if the Brazilians change their stance on environmental interests, the Bolsonaro government were kicked out last year, and the new Brazilian government are from the left and are progressive on climate change and on the environment. So that does change the dynamic. The other thing is there are a couple of strategic weaknesses in our argument. One is that we, while we are grass-based beef and dairy, we import hundreds of thousands of tons of animal feed, mostly from South America, a lot of it from Brazil and Argentina. And the second one is that as a country that is exporting to every country in the world, like there was a trade deal to China aboard BIA, our trade mission to China only last month. And while we're saying that, the environment is the preeminent concern when you look at how food is produced and moved around the world, for beef to be going from Ireland to China is jarring. So we have to be really careful how we message this.
Right, because our arguments, if we're insisting on environmental...
can be turned back on us.
And how much of a party, when you're dealing with, Mercosur counterparts at Martin Hayden, and you make the argument for Irish beef and it's, grass-fed integrity, they can point as well, though, to the way cattle are reared in Holland, where, indoor for a lot of the year, fed on silage, all of that kind of thing. We're a minority within Europe as to how we rear our beef, aren't we? Certain parts of Germany, maybe France, ourselves.
Well, we are. Our grass-based system is a unique selling point for us in the Northern Hemisphere.
But the point is, it's a minority. So if the European Union says, we've got environmentally friendly animal standards, they say, well, some of you do.
Yes, no, but our level of animal welfare standards are very high. Our level of traceability in terms of medicines and that applied to our animals is really, really high. Okay. But also the fact that the big challenge about Brazil is they're knocking rainforests. They're doing significant harm here to Clearfell to produce this beef.
Okay, all right. We'll go to some messages in from listeners by email. Coming in from Colm Fahey, I find it really ludicrous we're chasing high-value markets, which means using CO2 to export food produce to other markets, while all the fruit and veg on our shelves coming from Peru, Egypt and South Africa. The debate and the thinking is totally twisted and won't be fixed until farmers get off cap dependency train and the rest of us accept we don't have an entitlement to eat mangoes or avocados or strawberries in November unless we can do it ourselves. Second email from Terry says, if the price is lower, let's have more access to lamb from New Zealand, beef from Argentina, chicken and butter from France, pork, bacon and dairy from Scandinavia and dairy from the UK. And by text, somebody says, do the coming measures mean Northern Irish dairy trade will go beyond the current incredible volume and take over the dairy trade on this island? Question mark, exclamation mark, which